Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia, in for Mike Collins. In March of 2024, online sports betting went live in North Carolina. The bill, which then-Governor Roy Cooper signed into law, allows North Carolina residents over the age of 21 to bet on professional and college sports by computer, mobile app, or in person. Legal gambling has been available in parts of the state via casinos or our 20-year-old education lottery system, but over the past year, gambling has gotten even more accessible. Even if you don't partake in online sports betting, it's hard to escape it. Commercials during games are full of messaging from companies like FanDuel and DraftKings vying for your bet. Win probabilities update on the screen throughout the game, and it can be unavoidable and, as a viewer, a little annoying. For some, gambling is an added fun, recreational layer to a game, a friendly wager, and hopefully an easy way to make quick money. But for others, gambling can be much more serious and lead to financial strain and even addiction. North Carolinians have had access to a statewide gambling addiction hotline since 2008, but reports say since legalization of sports betting, calls have now doubled. Just 8 months after legalization, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services partnered with the newly formed Gambling Policy and Research Initiative at East Carolina University to increase awareness about the problem gambling and its effects on individuals, families, and communities. This hour on Charlotte Talks, we explore what happens when gambling becomes more than a game. How do you recognize the signs of a problem and what you can do about it? To tackle these issues and answer your questions, we have three guests. Allison Wood is the prevention coordinator at the NC Problem Gambling Program. Dr. Michelle Malkin is the director of the Gambling Research and Policy Initiative at East Carolina University. And Dr. Jessica Auslander is a licensed clinical addiction specialist that specializes and gambling counseling. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Good morning.
If you or somebody you know is struggling with gambling addiction, the North Carolina Problem Gambling Helpline is here to help. Their number is 877-718-5543. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be discussing the connection of problem gambling and addiction and suicide. And if you or somebody you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts, the national number for suicide and crisis lifeline is 988. So Dr. Auslander, I want to start with you. You're a licensed clinical addiction specialist that specializes in gambling counseling. When you first heard that online gambling was coming to the state of North Carolina, what was your reaction?
Probably something I shouldn't repeat on air.
Okay.
Immediately had this sense of urgency and sense of dread, because I know, you know, while gambling, you know, we're neutral about it. It's not good, it's not bad. It's just, it's a form of entertainment. And for most people, it stays that way. But for some people, it can become problematic behavior or a disorder. And for that group, the consequences can be really severe for themselves, their loved ones, the community. It really has a large impact. And I did not think at the time that, you know, we had the infrastructure to support an increase in the need for services, not just in gambling, but for mental health. In general, we know there's a lot of overlap and co-occurring disorders too. It's not just gambling disorder over here in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm doubly licensed as a clinical mental health counselor and an addiction to cover that. So when I heard that it was going to be more accessible and legalized, I just had this sense of dread that we weren't going to be able to meet the needs that were going to be coming down in the next few weeks or months.
And has it been as bad as you thought it was going to be?
Absolutely.
Oh, really?
From a clinical standpoint, you know, as I was preparing for this, I looked at my own data. I track my gambling hours. Since I moved to North Carolina and established my private practice here in 2017, I ran my numbers from 2017 to February of 24 and compared my numbers from March of 24 through February 25. And I had 112% increase and the time I was spending providing gambling directed services. So my caseload, my time spent gambling week to week in my therapy practice, slightly more than doubled in just that time frame. So that's pretty significant.
Yeah. And who are these people that you're seeing? Are they folks that are new to gambling that got maybe sucked in through sports betting online? Or are these people that have had an issue for a while and are now just seeking help? Do you have a sense? Are there any trends that are emerging?
I think it's a balance. Definitely emerging adults, so young adults, mostly male, getting kind of really interested in sports betting, and maybe they have a prior history of use or abuse of maybe substances, or maybe internet use, or other electronics-based behavior was already kind of pushing it. Maybe some history of untreated or undertreated attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And that sports betting really has just kind of telescoped them into this level of severity they were not expecting. And then I have some that really gambling was kind of part of their culture. Maybe they got that lottery ticket and a birthday card or a Christmas stocking. So that seed was planted when their brain was very young. And maybe it's kind of been off and on, but with sports betting being more acceptable and accessible, they're engaging in it more, and it's kind of getting out of hand from there. But of my clients that I've taken on in the last year, I've had several that have returned. So maybe they had an issue with a different form of gambling, but seeing all the advertisement, hearing it and seeing it constantly is a trigger, and they're kind of coming in for maintenance and support so they don't have a slip or a relapse. I have a client that I've been working with for a while that has struggled with it since the age of 9 years old.
Wow.
So we don't want to stereotype that it only happens in adulthood, or it only happens to these college guys getting too carried away with sports betting, or it's only, the widow that got into the lottery. Like, it really can happen any time across the lifespan, depending on when they're exposed to it. Very similar to the model we have for drugs and alcohol.
Well, experts are finding that as the number of online bets go up, so do the calls for help to the North Carolina Problem Gambling Helpline. That hotline used to average about 50 calls a month, and I believe that's closer to 115 calls a month. Dr. Malkin, do we know if that average is holding steady? Are there any indicators that it will go up?
So, not surprised at all that we've had a huge increase in the number of calls to the hotline. Every state that has passed the legislation to allow sports wagering on mobile sports wagering has had that kind of increase. What we do find among the numbers from the hotline is about 50% are people seeking help, and the rest are people who are the loved ones impacted by somebody, and they're trying to figure out how to kind of help their loved one. But what we do know is somebody needs to want to help themselves. But the helpline is definitely a place where people are seeking information. And part of the reason of the increase, I believe, in almost every state, including here in North Carolina, is that that number is being put out so much more because of the advertising that people know it exists, because people didn't even know about it because we weren't advertising it anywhere except on very small print on the back of lottery tickets. And so the problem, though, is that we're not seeing a decrease. It's continuously increasing because at what we know about the progression of gambling disorder, which is the medical term for problem gambling, it takes time for that to form. And what we also know is that mobile sports wagering and kind of the ability for prop bets and gambling quickly, as well as iGaming, which is not legal, that's casino gambling on your mobile phone. It's not legal here, but there's a million ways to gamble in that way on your mobile phone, even if it's not legal. We also have sweepstakes, which is a lot like having slot machines all over the state. And so what we have is those are the forms of gambling that can lead to gambling disorder quicker because of the style of gambling, how quick it all is. And so we're going to see an increase even faster beyond that 115 calls within the next 2 years. I can almost guarantee that. And that's what we're seeing in those states that passed sports wagering and or iGaming starting in 2020, that the calls are not decreasing, they're just increasing as more
Increasing.
people. go down that pathway towards gambling disorder.
I wanted to ask the panel as a whole, and Allison, I'm going to start with you, if there's a sense of what impact the economy has on problem gambling. I mean, people are worried about the price of eggs and affording groceries right now. Are they more likely to be impulsive and take a risk to see if that will help?
Well, I think you have to first go back to the fact that we have easy access to gambling now, easier access than we've ever had. And then when you couple that with persuasive design online, you get the lack of impulse control and loss of inhibition, which of course, Dr. Malkin and Dr. Esslinger pointed to, it takes some time to develop. But also with high frequency betting or these high frequency rewards that are happening online, it's almost like a slot machine, which has been coined the, you know, the cocaine of, you know, the gambling industry, because you can bet so often. So you have that impact. But then you have the impact of the illusion of control that's reinforced in marketing and advertising. And what this does is make people believe they have some type of control over gambling, when no gambling will make you money in the long run, including sports betting. And because this illusion of control is emphasized, a lot of people see gambling as a way to make money. Now, traditionally, this has been seen as a socioeconomic issue, but now we're seeing a lot of white, upper, and middle-class America also engaging in this as a possible way to make money, when that's just not true. So if you're looking at people that are now spending tons of money on gambling, sports betting, you also see maybe they are investing less or saving less, or they're not even able to meet their monthly bills. So it's certainly, there are a lot of social and economic harms that are currently existing.
Dr. Malkin.
I just want to add to what Allison Wu was saying. What we do know is people at low socioeconomic status are more likely to engage in the less expensive types of gambling, like lottery or low wage gambling online. But their goal is to get themselves kind of out of that situation. I actually recently had the story of an individual who said that when mom won, we ate really well, but when mom lost, we didn't eat much at all. And that's what you kind of see in lower socioeconomic status situations. And so the GRPI is actually going to be doing a study among 10 of the cities that have the lowest socioeconomic status in North Carolina, so that we can better understand what is happening. And right now, as the economy seems to be going down, we can anticipate that people will look to gambling as a way to fix their situation.
Dr. Hosslander, did you want to weigh in as well?
I frequently hear stories from my emerging adult group. You think of students in high school and college, and they're looking at kind of a bleaker economic outlook, right? They're watching the price of housing and what's happened to that since the pandemic, and tuition and student loans and all of these national conversations we're having and the economic impact, and recognizing that, okay, it's harder to get jobs, or I'm not going to do as well financially right out of college as my parents may have done. So they're looking for ways to kind of bridge and supplement that. Because we're already experiencing, I think, a bit of a failure to launch situation economically for many of these young adults, and even people, you know, anyone who's kind of graduated in the last 5 to 8 years has probably started to feel the impact of that. So I have many of my high school and college students seeing gambling as a way to avoid those consequences.
When we come back, we're going to dive into some of the research that Dr. Malkin is conducting on problem gambling and look at some of the groups that may be more vulnerable than others. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia in for Mike Collins. We're back discussing what some lawmakers have considered a public health crisis, gambling addiction, especially since online sports betting has gone live in North Carolina as of March of last year. My guests today are Allison Wood, the prevention coordinator at the NC Problem Gambling Program. Dr. Michelle Malkin is the director of the Gambling Research and Policy Initiative at East Carolina University. And Dr. Jessica Auslander, a licensed clinical addiction specialist that specializes in gambling counseling. Dr. Malkin, I want to start with you this segment. You all are conducting vital research and looking at emerging trends and impacts of problem gambling, as well as looking at historically marginalized and understudied populations in North Carolina. One of the areas of focus emerging is college students. What do we know about college students and their relationship with gambling?
Thank you so much. I will say that the college students kind of fall into this larger group of emerging adults, individuals kind of under the age of 25 who are engaging in gambling at higher rates than ever before. It's a lot easier to do studies among college students because they're within the campus environment. But we do need a lot more around emerging adults, which we're working on right now. But when we look at college students, what we know is about 67% of college students across the state of North Carolina are gambling, whether it's legal or not. This was based on research we did just prior to the launch of mobile wagering. And we found that about 82% of our males and still over 60% of our females were engaging in gambling behavior within the past year. So gambling is a frequent activity among this population. The thing that concerns us the most is about 13% of college males have suffered from at least one gambling-related harm within the last year. And so putting together the resources for our emerging adults and specifically our college students is really important, because what we also discovered is almost no students had received any education at all on campus around gambling and how to gamble in kind of a healthy way. They hadn't been screened for gambling disorder too. And I just want to say that I kind of have been putting out this idea that we say, if you have a problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER or whatever the hotline number is, but people don't know what it looks like to have a problem. Mm-hmm. We haven't done the education to help anybody of any age understand what that looks like. And we know that students don't have resources on campus if they are suffering from gambling related harms, because doctors like Dr. Auslander are not on those campuses, but students are going to go to their campus counseling center. So we at the GRPI have been working with our wellness program at ECU, as well as some others, and we've been developing all those resources. So with the help of Allison Wood and her problem gambling program and TELUS, we've been developing curriculum for campuses to use. We've been working with national counselors to develop a micro-credential for campus counselors. And we are also creating the Emerging Adult Gambling Screen, which we call the EAGS. And that is because we find that most screeners do not capture the gambling-related harms of younger people. They just don't have the kind of experiences that the typical screeners are using. So we are working on all those, and we are having a North Carolina College Student Gambling Summit in April to share all this information and resources with college campuses all over the state. And as of right now, we have almost 20 campuses and close to 65 people coming to that, so that we can really make that change here in North Carolina. So while we're doing the research, we're also trying to address the problems that we're finding in that research.
When you talk about gambling-related harms, can you give me some examples of what that means exactly?
Absolutely. For some people, it means losing their rent for the first time because they gambled it away. Mm. It could be that they have a relationship that is strained because of one person's kind of obsession with gambling. It could be legal problems, from civil cases to criminal cases. We know that over 50% of people with severe gambling disorder will actually commit a gambling motivated crime. We also know that one in five, 20% of individuals with gambling disorder have very high suicidal ideation. The good news that we've found through our research, though, is for those people who do seek help, that do get the help they need and stay away from gambling for at least a year, that suicidal ideation goes from almost 20% to 2.7%. So people like Dr. Auslander and the work that they do is really making a difference to reduce that suicidal ideation among people with gambling disorder.
Well, I wanted to talk about this legal age of being able to do online betting in North Carolina. It's 21, but I imagine there are ways around that. And there are lots of people who are not 21 and that are younger that are placing these bets. Question for the panel. I mean, how do you combat that? I mean, is it education? Where do you go from there when you can't really control who's going to participate in this, whether they're 21 or not? Allison, I'll start with you.
Education is really key. As we all know, knowledge is power. And it's important to integrate youth prevention, education, and mental health promotion, along with this idea of understanding our emotions and how they impact our decisions. And really, that should be taught in schools and after school programs, as well as understanding the whole digital landscape and how it is now an integral part of our life and how it impacts our brain health, and really getting to the neurobiology behind it. We all need to understand how toxic stress, how artificial dopamine impacts the way that we live and also impacts our mental and physical health. So really, this could be in multiple places in education, but it needs to be there alongside with alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs, because what we're seeing in the data of the youth that participate in our youth prevention programs is that they've been gambling for quite some time, even when it's been illegal. We also see that these same kids that are gambling are also engaging in other high-risk behaviors. If you look at the Youth Behavior Risk Survey and you start to compare youth that are gambling, well, those youth are also, you know, using substances, maybe driving under the influence, maybe engaging in other high-risk behaviors. So really what we're looking at is providing youth with instrumental health education so they can rise with the knowledge and power that they have the ability to regulate their nervous system, that they have the ability to choose and make smarter decisions based on understanding our neurobiology and how to pause and think through things and not act on impulse. So yes, clearly we need youth prevention education programs, but we also have to figure out a way to reach our parents, because parents are stressed with the economy already. They are stressed because of the pandemic. And this toxic stress, what that does, it messes with our brain health and messes with our mental and physical health. So if we have stressed out parents, then they can't even begin to have the conversation with their young people. But they are also in the dark. They are also lacking this information so they can provide this and empower their kids. So really, we have a huge job and just not enough resources to do it. But hopefully, working cross-sectionally, we can meet more of these goals.
Dr. Malkin, did I see a hand?
Yes, I just wanted to add that we do see gambling being generational. So oftentimes young people are brought into gambling by their own family members who think that it's an okay thing to do with young people. During the holiday season, we do a whole kind of media campaign saying, do not buy scratch-off tickets for your young people. That is not the intention. And part of the reason is what we know is an early win can really be the impetus for somebody going down that pathway towards gambling disorder. And that is because of the research we have on the brain. Gambling looks like cocaine addiction more than it looks like a healthy gambler when somebody has gambling disorder. Their reward pathways, everything is impacted by that early win. What we're seeing with sports wagering, though, is that young people are so understanding of these apps around sports that the parents will ask the young person to help them place their bets. And so then if that individual, if the bet wins, what happens is the parents really excited. They're saying, we won. And it teaches this young person that gambling is really fun and is okay. The other thing we know about young people is that they are engaging in gambling behavior within video games in a number of ways. First of all, video games have gambling style engagement, including casinos right there in social games, as well as other kinds of video games. But also what we see is that individuals in video games may buy loot boxes or mystery boxes, which is a form of gambling that is being done by, you know, 8-year-olds.
Wow. Dr. Auslander, I think you wanted to weigh in on that as well.
Yeah. So when, I'm working with people, they usually have no idea there is an age limit. They were doing it anyway. That was not a factor. Like the legality of it is not a factor, because young people assume if it's accessible, right, then it's okay. And with that age being 21, where's the science behind that number? Because brain development actually continues between 25, 26 years old. So we're still getting this like coding, this neural sheathing of all these neurons connecting over our brain and getting our prefrontal cortex, the thinking part of your brain, more connected so we can make better decisions. Now, that's not to say I don't want everyone to consider every major life choice they made before the age of 26, but we know that critical thinking improves, impulsivity tends to go down just on this normal developmental arc. So when we introduce things, whether it be gambling, substances, alcohol, anything like that before the brain is fully mature, it does affect development. Hmm. So when gambling is introduced in a cultural sense or a family tradition sense at a young age, and that young person tends to be possibly genetically predisposed to having that reaction, that addiction type reaction to it, parents often aren't prepared for that. A big part of gambling is secrecy. If something lights up the brain, whether it be a substance or a behavior, the brain is going to try to protect it, thinking it's necessary. So the secrecy just becomes second nature. It's not an intentional lying to harm the friends and family members. It's the brain's instinct to protect this thing that makes us feel really good and maybe counters that toxic stress, to Allison's point, right? So, when we see young people kind of develop with that, it can really get negative very quickly as they grow and develop. So having this age limit of 21, probably to make it in line with alcohol, that's still not really backed by neuroscience.
One word that's come up a lot in this conversation is dopamine, and that's where we're headed next. I was wondering what kind of dopamine hits, especially online sports betting, where it's literally in your hand, provides for people, especially if you have something like anxiety or depression or ADHD, where dopamine can be hard to come by. How careful, much more careful do those kind of folks that are susceptible to those disorders need to be when considering placing a bet? I'll start with you, Dr. Malkin.
Thank you. I'd say that we don't have a magic answer on who's going to cross over into problematic gambling behavior and gambling disorder. It's not an automatic, this person, because of these backgrounds, would do it. What we know is that certain kinds of activities are more likely to lead to gambling disorder. We know there's a high incidence of ADHD, as Dr. Auchlander mentioned, and its connection to gambling, but we don't have the research yet. Unfortunately, most of the money that goes into gambling right now is done by the states, and they are focused on outreach and prevention. They are not focused on research. We're very lucky here in North Carolina that DHHS, Problem Gambling Program, valued research, but we don't have the kind of research we need to be able to answer questions such as that, because so much more money needs to go into that. And as of right now, there are no federal funds for gambling research. It's just never been part of the federal government's focus, even though they get money from wins all over, whether it's from casinos or sports wagering. The federal government gets money from gambling, but they put it towards other purposes.
Well, one statistic that was really alarming for me when I was getting ready for the show was that studies are showing gambling disorder has the highest suicide rate of all addictions. And I want to give that number out again. If you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts, the number for the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is 988. Another area of focus the gambling research and policy initiative is looking at is suicidal ideation, Dr. Malkin, and that refers to the thoughts, fantasies, or contemplations about ending one's own life. We know that gambling disorder has the highest suicide rate of all addictions, but why is that? Why that surprised me. There are so many different things you can be addicted to. Why is gambling disorder prone to that?
This goes right back to what was said about gambling being such a secretive activity. You can smell alcohol. You can sometimes tell that somebody is using drugs, but most people are shocked to learn that a loved one has gambled the way they have and gone into incredible debt and broken relationships and things like that. And it's all about shame and guilt. So the person who starts gambling does not know that they can end up going down this pathway of going towards gambling-related harms. And what we know is this whole idea of the gambler's fallacy. So gambling will cause a number of different kinds of gambling-related harms: social, economic, employment, education, legal. And what happens in the brain of the person who is a gambler is they need to fix those issues by keeping gambling. The gambling is going to fix those because the next win will fix all these problems, not just the economic problems, but the relationship problems. And so I call this the gambler's fallacy. And so what happens is they end up digging their hole deeper and deeper and deeper. And then that shame and guilt gets higher and higher. I never thought I could do dot, dot, dot. Mm-hmm. I never thought I would take the money of my partner without their knowledge. I never thought I would do these things. And that shame and guilt connected to that, without the kind of education and understanding that Allison is so good at trying to get out into our community, people just don't know that they can go down this pathway. And so that shame and guilt is essential to what is leading to suicidal ideation. They'd rather not have to deal with it because they don't know that help works. They don't want to stop gambling because gambling's become their best friend. Gambling's become what they enjoy doing during all their time, including while they're working, while they're studying, they are gambling. And so their brain is never stopping gambling, because even when they're not gambling, they're thinking about, how am I going to get money to win back my losses? So there's never a time when the brain is shut off once somebody kind of goes down that pathway towards gambling disorder. And so the only way to stop those thoughts becomes suicide. And unfortunately, we lose a lot of people to this. And it's really a big problem with the emerging adult population and adolescents, because they are already at a higher rate of suicidal ideation and actually following through and having a suicidal attempt or completion. And so we need to get as much information out to those individuals and teach people how to go towards somebody who they think is having a problem and actually have the conversation with them to help that person get the help they need, rather than the end result being something so severe.
Well, like so many addictions, the impact doesn't stop with only the individual. When we come back, we'll look into identifying the problem when it becomes more than a game and seeking treatment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia. We've been discussing gambling disorders and the rise of those seeking help. The NC Problem Gambling Hotline is now averaging more than 100 calls a month. That's double the amount compared to before online sports betting was legalized in North Carolina. We want to spend the rest of our conversation today talking about treatment and making that call for help. If you have any questions or comments, write us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're here with Allison Wood, the Prevention Coordinator at the NC Problem Gambling Program. Dr. Michelle Malkin is the director of the Gambling Research and Policy Initiative at East Carolina University. And Dr. Jessica Auslander is a licensed clinical addiction specialist that specializes in gambling counseling. So Dr. Auslander, I want to get a basic understanding for problem gambling and gambling disorders. How do you describe when it becomes not just a game, but a problem?
When we start to see those gambling-related harms that Dr. Malkin was discussing earlier, now that's going to vary by individual. I hear a lot of, well, I've only lost 500. It's not like I've lost 10,000, right? We don't look at that financial scale. We look at that impact to someone's personal life. Are they having relationship trouble? Those emerging adults, did a parent realize that the student loan money is gone and didn't go towards tuition, right? Or they can't pay that rent on that apartment they finally got so they could get out of the dorms. Are they missing time from work? Are they withdrawing socially? Are they having maybe some co-occurring health issues from the anxiety and the stress? We talked before, the overlap with that in iGaming. If they're spending so much time playing, or as we say, in action, that they're not taking care of their bodies. Are they dehydrated? Are they not eating? Are they not grooming? Things like that. There's a multitude of possible harms that's related to gambling behavior. So when someone recognizes that they start to kind of cross that line, we do want them to reach out and get help as soon as possible. But again, due to that secrecy, the shame and blame kind of aspect, how the brain responds and kind of turns inward, they frequently don't ask for help until they're very much farther down the line of potential harms.
Can you be a gambler for years and not have an issue? It's something that you do occasionally. It's something for fun. And then suddenly you do have an issue. Is there a switch that flips, or how does that work?
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, similar to any other substance or behavior. You can use it responsibly, and then maybe there is a traumatic event. Maybe there's something overwhelming that, you know, puts that brain into that toxic stress, and it just wants that dopamine to feel better. And people realize they kind of slide more into that, we call it maladaptive coping, or coping that isn't exactly helpful, into that pattern over time. For some people, I work with people that say, you know, I just don't understand what happened to me. I played bingo for years at the VFW without a problem. But all of a sudden, you know, my brother takes me to a casino and I couldn't stop going. So there's a lot of individual differences and factors at play. So in treatment, we look at that from a very, you know, individual perspective to figure out what is that person's background and story and what did contribute to it kind of turning that corner for them and becoming a problem.
I see everyone on the panel kind of nodding their heads at what you were just saying, Jessica. And Allison, I want to bring you into the conversation. I want to backtrack for a second and talk a little bit about gender. Does gender play a role? Are more men or women susceptible to problem gambling? Do we see any trends when it comes to gender?
So typically, yes, we have seen more men impacted by gambling harms than women. But it's really important to understand that women are starting to engage in gambling at higher rates and also experiencing problems. I know Dr. Malkin has some research to speak to this, but let's just give an example of the social casino gaming world, which mimics traditional style slot machines, but you don't get money in return. Predominantly, women are playing these games and becoming addicted to them, even when they're not getting money back in return. So we have to understand that we have to redefine the definition of gambling, because there's a lot of unregulated and illegal gambling going on that does not fit legal jurisdictions' definitions of gambling. But there are still harms happening. So we have to realize that we need more money and research to understand the full impact on special populations.
Dr. Malkin?
So thank you so much for that introduction to the research we are doing, Allison. I think it's just really important to know that while men are introduced to gambling usually at younger ages, and therefore it becomes socially acceptable very young, and so we have a larger percentage of men by the age of 18 already gambling, by the age of 25 already gambling, what we're seeing is more and more women being introduced at younger ages because of the social forms of gambling and the social acceptance of gambling in different ways. What our research has found is once somebody crosses over into gambling disorder, there's absolutely no difference in the number and types of gambling-related harms they suffer. So while traditionally it's been more men than women, now that we have an increase in women, we're able to see that women have the exact same experiences with gambling disorder and the impact of gambling disorder as men. And so too much of our former research has been focused on men because they were the predominant group seeking help. And too few of our resources, therefore, were going towards impacting kind of the education and prevention of women. And so that's being changed right now. But our research very much shows that women are engaged, and that we also find that intersectionality really matters. For example, African American women engage in gambling at higher rates than Caucasian women, and that African American men are at higher rates of certain kinds of gambling, but they're not necessarily always doing the traditional regulated gambling that we see.
We've talked a little bit about if you think that you might have a problem or noticing some of those signs, but what if you have a loved one or a friend or a coworker and you're starting to notice certain things and wondering if they have a problem? I mean, what are the first steps that you should take to help someone get help, even though knowing that person has to want the help in order to change?
I can just say that what we've found is that one-on-one calm discussions, not blaming, is just really important. But I think Dr. Auschlander could actually talk more about the loved ones, what we call the affected others, from those that are affected. And what we know is with gambling disorder, the average person impacts 7 to 9 additional people by their gambling. So there is a lot to be done in that realm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's important to remember that, you know, the way the brain responds to this, just like other addictions, it doesn't have a lot of insight. So the person really does not think they have a problem. It's not that they're just being defensive and I don't want you to bug me. They really don't believe it's an issue, right? That gambler fallacy, well, gambling will also solve the problem that's creating, or it makes me feel good. Or when we talk about the dopamine hits with sports betting, it's not just placing a bet and do I win. Sports itself is a giant dopamine hit, right? Such a big part of our culture. You know, we all have our favorite teams that we cheer for and like rivalries and things like that. So there's this double social connection, you know, the dopamine hit and the betting. So when someone is concerned about someone else's gambling, it's important to remember that they are not going to see things the way you see them. And to have that conversation, you know, to Michelle's point, it's not the blame game. You know, it's not the, well, you're doing this. It's, I'm noticing this. Hey, it seems to be you're asking for help financially a little bit more. Can, you know, how can we support you? All right. And looking at maybe the underlying reason the person is reaching out for that gambling. I'm in a little bit of a sticky position because I'm the only ICGC2 in the state of North Carolina. And we have a credential. So I'm an internationally certified gambling counselor. Mm-hmm. An ICGC2 means that I have over 2,000 hours of experience. I've been treating gambling since 2013, started in Ohio. Now I've been in North Carolina working since 2017. And I'm the only certified gambling counselor physically in the state line. So what frequently happens is that I will get calls from family members and I'm educating them. And I take those calls, and those consult calls will go beyond my standard 20 minute prospective client. Cause I understand if you've picked up that 800 pound phone, right, to call, I want to try to catch you. And I hear them have to make a decision. Are they going to work with me, or are they going to send their loved ones to me? Because they don't feel like there's equal resources for both. Mm. We do have, you know, a training program. There are other providers that have had some basic training in gambling disorder, hopefully getting those hours in. But since I have been here, you know, for 8 or 9 years, I'm still the only ICGC physically located within the state. I think there's one more who is in another state and has telehealth. It's not the same. Some people do prefer that in person. I've been certified in telehealth for 20 years, so it definitely has its place. Sometimes with this population, especially with the high suicidality, in person can be a better fit. So we don't have the breadth of treatment resources that we need to catch those 7 to 9 affected, as well as that person with the gambling disorder. And I'll frequently get calls and I just hear the family trying to decide who comes to see me, because ethically I can't see both. Mm. We can do family, right? It's a different modality, but really those should be two separate therapeutic environments, and it becomes very challenging. So to go back to the very first question at the top of the hour, that's why my reaction was something I can't repeat, because I realized I felt like, okay, I'm pretty much it in terms of that level of credentialing and experience. And I know that as we are trying to build a system, and Allison's doing some fantastic work in prevention, we really need more resources across the entire spectrum.
Yeah. Dr. Malkin.
I just want to say we need more resources also on the east side of the state. Been working really hard to try to do that. But I do want to say that North Carolina offers up to 12 free sessions, and they're kind of the payer of last resort. So if the individual doesn't have insurance that covers it, that is what's covered by the state. And we do offer that. Once somebody calls the 1-800 number for the state, they are given that opportunity. But a lot of people don't take advantage of it. And that is there for the gambler as well as the affected other.
Allison.
I just wanted to add, yes, we do have a small budget and we're not federally funded, but we have had trained providers across the state, not to Dr. Aslander's level, which we would love for everybody to do that. But many of our practitioners who are on our registry would not see as many problem gambling clients or those affected by problem gambling than other clients with primary other addictions or other mental health disorders. So that has a lot to do with the lack of knowledge that gambling can even become a disorder. But it also has the fact that there's been so much illegal gambling and so it's not regulated and then they don't provide a helpline number. So no one knows there's even treatment available. So we've got a lot of things going on here. One of the things that Tiffany and Amanda, who are part of my team, are doing, they're working with an online telehealth provider, Burtis Health, and they're specific, really focusing on figuring out treatment modalities specific to those affected by problem gambling. So we're trying a few things here and there. We want more Dr. Aslanders across the entire state of North Carolina, but also the United States. But I see is more people that are identifying clients that are having, you know, gambling harms, that, you know, there'll be more attention to this. And I'm already seeing that with like the Addictions Professionals Group of North Carolina starting to focus more on problem gambling, as well as North Carolina Foundation of Alcohol and Drug Studies. They're also focusing more on problem gambling. So hopefully the federal dollars will also follow unfortunately, the uptick in those experiencing harms because the awareness has raised, but also those in clinical practice that want to focus on it.
Dr. Malkin.
I just want to address the first question that you asked Dr. Aslander, and I want to tell you that I had a slightly different response to her that fits right into this conversation. And that is that I used to think the expansion of legalized gambling was problematic, that too many people are going to go down this path. But what I've found through research is that people are gambling in legal and illegal ways, whether we regulate it or not. So legal and regulated gambling is better than illegal and unregulated because it has those resources, but it comes with responsibility. And that responsibility is on the state, on the federal government, on those who receive the proceeds, the industry, to ensure that we have outreach, prevention, education, treatment, and research being done. And unfortunately for gambling, that responsibility has not always been part of the movement towards legalization, but that's what it comes with.
We only have a couple of minutes left in the show, but I did want to add and ask the question. I mean, imagine if you are somebody who has a gambling disorder and you're in a hole financially, making the call for help might be even more daunting because you're going to think, how much is that going to cost me? Are there any free resources? What can I do? I mean, what do you say to folks that are in that situation? Dr. Malkin, I'll start with you.
Well, I think we mentioned it a little bit, but if they call the 1-800 number, that is the first way towards getting resources. They can also look online at morethanagame.com. That is part of the North Carolina kind of problem gambling program to see what resources exist. But there are free resources throughout the state. It does not have to cost anything out of pocket. We are very used to, it's morethanagame.nc.gov. I'm glad you indicated that. But it's really important that people know there's resources and that there's lots of ways to seek help. There's not one way, and not one way works for everybody. There are people who are seeking help through social media like Facebook and things like that. There's a lot of resources out there. The most important thing is asking for help and making that first decision to seek help and to get resources. Gamblers Anonymous exists throughout the country, throughout the world. And that, of course, is one of the easiest free resources for everybody to start getting help if they need it. And they have online meetings as well as in person.
Dr. Aslander, as we wrap up, I want to give you the last word and make the case for anyone that is listening right now that may need help. What would you say to them?
Pick up a phone, go online, reach out. Help is available. One of the questions I get is, will my insurance cover it? In most cases, yes. Some policies still carve out gambling disorder, but addiction is a medical condition. It was defined as such in the 1950s. Gambling was moved into the addiction category in 2013. It is a medical disorder. Your insurance will cover it in most cases. If not, there are free resources, but please pick up the phone because it's not worth the damage to yourself and others if you don't get help.
If you or someone you know is struggling with gambling addiction, the North Carolina Problem Gambling Helpline is here to help. Their number is 877-718-5543. I want to thank all my guests today for joining us. I'm Sarah D'Elia. This has been Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.